This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you talked to Chuck any time in the last couple of years, he, in the person of your broker at Charles Schwab, may have told you about an investment called auction rate securities. If you bought them and held them until last fall's economic collapse, well, you may not be talking to Chuck anymore. But the New York Attorney General is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 17th dog day of August. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo sued brokerage giant Charles Schwab today. He's accusing Schwab of fraud and of misleading investors when it sold them complicated securities that imploded at the beginning of the financial crisis. They're called auction rate securities, and Cuomo already went after big Wall Street banks that dreamed them up. Jill Barshay has the latest from the desk of Don't Ever Buy What You Don't Understand.
Charles Schwab says it didn't create these auction rate securities, and it shouldn't take the blame for the damage they've done. But securities lawyer Jacob Zemanski says Schwab's executives knew there were problems with these products, and yet they continued selling them to customers.
Schwab brokers were pitching the auction rate securities as cash equivalents. They didn't disclose to investors that the auctions were failing and that their money could be frozen for years.
Schwab says it was as duped by the Wall Street banks as its customers were, but that's hardly reassuring to the public. Mark Johansson is the chair of the Financial Planners Association. He says this and other scandals are making it hard for consumers to know who they can trust with their money.
There's no doubt that our profession has been tarnished as well. As a financial planner and investment advisor, we now get questions from clients in ways that we never did before.
Johansson says he's working on a new industry standard to safeguard consumers. But securities lawyer Zemanski says individual investors need to do a better job of looking out for themselves. He says banks and brokerages still aren't telling the whole truth about many of the financial products they sell.
Investors really need to do their own homework because there have been so many problems on Wall Street.
Zemanski doesn't expect Cuomo to stop with Schwab. There are plenty of other big brokers in the attorney general's sights. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The healthcare debate continues to rage at town halls and on cable TV, or should I say the rage continues in the healthcare debate. Now the Obama administration is hinting it could live without the so-called public option. The idea was to have a government-run plan that would compete with private insurers and force costs down. But if the public option is out, what's in? And is meaningful reform still possible? Tamara Keith has more from Washington.
How much the public plan matters all depends on who you ask. Former Democratic Party Chairman Howard Dean talked about it on the Today Show this morning.
You're not going to have real reform without some kind of a public option. That's pretty clear.
There are plenty of Democrats in Congress who agree with him. So President Obama may ultimately have to convince members of his own party that healthcare legislation is worth supporting, even without a public plan. Paul Ginsburg, president of the Center for Studying Health System Change, says a public plan was never the most important part of a healthcare overhaul.
Many aspects of reform of the insurance market that seem to be accepted by both Democrats and moderate Republicans, House and Senate, are much more important than the public plan.
Those changes include requiring more people to have health insurance and not allowing insurance companies to reject people with pre-existing conditions. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
If imitation really is the sincerest form of flattery, organizers of those town hall protests can take this next story as a big fat compliment. Big oil and coal companies are using their trade associations to organize what would appear to be grassroots protests against the climate bill working its way through Congress. Notice I said appear to be. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
The American Petroleum Institute is Big Oil's lobbying muscle in Washington, and the group's planning a long, hot summer for dozens of members of Congress. Earlier this month, API sent out a memo to its members asking them to turn out hundreds of employees for protests in more than 20 states. The aim? To undermine support for the climate change bill in Congress.
Anytime a trade association tries to portray their activities as grassroots activity when it's clearly being orchestrated by corporate headquarters, that raises very serious questions about making sure that the public really understands what's going on.
Dan Lashoff directs the Climate Center at the National Resources Defense Council. He says many groups are attempting to pass off corporate opposition to this bill as a grassroots uprising. Earlier this summer, a lobby shop working for the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, or ACE,
fabricated letters to members of Congress, literally forged letters.
From local chapters of the NAACP and other civil rights groups.
Opposing climate legislation in the House, and it turned out that those organizations had not sent any such letters.
ACE apologized and fired the lobbyists. But Lashoff is equally disturbed by another part of this story. Many companies that belong to the American Petroleum Institute and ACE say publicly, at least, that they support legislation to combat climate change. So he wonders why their trade representatives are actively opposing it. Tom Williams is a spokesman for Duke Energy. His company has left other trade associations over this issue, but
I think Duke Energy has been a moderating influence on the membership of ACE overall.
And still, other firms are playing both sides of the aisle. For example, BP's spent millions creating a green corporate image, but it's working with the American Petroleum Institute on wrestling up employees for the upcoming protests. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And to see the American Petroleum Institute's lobbying plan or to check out some of those forged letters, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. On Wall Street, traders did not appreciate Monday coming around yet again. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Five more bank failures were announced over the weekend. The news made a relatively small splash, which might say something about how far the economic meltdown has come. Last year, there were 25 bank failures across the land. Just 8 months into this year, there are 77 more. Many analysts are worried that a struggling Texas bank could be next on the list. Federal regulators are asking for buyout bids by today for Guaranty Financial. We asked Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon to find out why bank failures are rising at this point in the financial crisis.
Remember all those toxic assets we haven't been talking so much about lately? They've never really gone away, and they're still dragging down many of the nation's banks. Brace yourself. Penn State professor John Mason says this is going to be a lingering problem.
We're in the period where we're working these assets off. It can be a relatively orderly process, but it takes time.
Notice how vaguely he worded that? Mason says it takes time is the best he can do. He points out the American economy didn't work off all its bad loans from the Depression era until after the Second World War. Mason says at least we have an idea how many banks are on the critical list. He's got his fingers crossed, though, that businesses and homeowners can afford to keep making the payments that many banks on the brink are desperately counting on.
It's the unidentified things now that you worry about. You don't want any major bomb to drop.
That's why it's critical for regulators to move swiftly to put zombie banks out of their misery. So says banking consultant Bert Ely, who sees that as a key lesson learned during the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s.
It is far better for all concerned that insolvent and failing banks be closed sooner rather than later. A failing bank is much more like a fresh-caught fish than a fine red wine. It does not get better with age.
The negative fallout of all the lingering trouble and doubt was underscored today by the Treasury Department. It reported lending by the biggest banks getting government rescue money fell for a fifth consecutive month in June, which only puts a bigger drag on the economy. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
As we mentioned earlier, the Obama administration may be backing away from the idea of having a government-run health insurance plan that competes with for-profit insurance companies. But the president is still hoping to squeeze big-time savings out of an industry that brings in roughly $700 billion a year while leaving millions of Americans underinsured. Sounds great, unless you happen to work for an insurance company. As part of our series, The Cure, Joel Rose reports.
I wasn't the first person to ask for a tour of Aetna's campus in the Philadelphia suburb of Bluebell. Apparently, the company's clients do it all the time.
They want to come and see the operation, and we say, well, it kind of looks like cubicles. So we want to see it.
That's Don Liss, Aetna's director of medicine for the Mid-Atlantic region. He escorted me from one end of the campus to the other. For an industry that generates billions of dollars in profits each year and that's at the center of a national drama, there isn't much to see, just lots of people sitting in cubicles, poring over claims, processing premiums, and making decisions about who gets insurance and who gets denied.
One of the big misconceptions is that someone is sitting at a desk, like rubber stamping things negatively.
Christy Rue was a hospital nurse for 10 years. She doesn't have a rubber stamp, but as a case manager, it's her job to explain to patients what their Aetna policies cover, and more often, what they do not and why. Like other Aetna employees I talked to, Rue is acutely aware that people think she works for the evil empire.
When I first came here, people said, oh, you went to the dark side. And, you know, your hospital cohorts would joke like that. But really, for me as a nurse, I couldn't work in a job where I wasn't doing what I went into this field to do.
Rue is one of 4,000 Aetna employees who work on this campus alone. Aetna has offices all over the country. Overall, the insurance industry employs roughly 500,000 people nationwide in sales, marketing, underwriting, and lots of other administrative jobs. Jacob Hacker teaches political science at Yale. He says private insurers spend 12 cents of every dollar on administrative costs, compared to only 2 cents for Medicare.
Private insurance companies are dealing with a system in which there's lots of reasons why they need to spend money on administration.
Hacker says a big chunk of that spending is devoted to figuring out who's too risky, meaning too sick to cover. Insurance companies also have to deal with regulations that differ from state to state. These are some of the reasons Hacker and others want to see a new government-funded health insurance option.
The public plan doesn't have to earn profits. It can have a much more simple process for paying providers. The money that's spent now trying to screen out high-cost people, the money that's spent now to deal with the patchwork of different state rules, all that will be reduced.
Hacker says all that could be more than $100 billion over 10 years. Not a big share of the $1 trillion or so needed to pay for health reform, but not insignificant either. Big insurers hate the idea. Alan Katz is a former VP at insurance giant WellPoint and now writes a blog about the industry.
If a government-run plan is introduced into the marketplace, there will be an irresistible temptation for lawmakers to tinker with it and to pile on advantages that will eventually lead to a death spiral in the marketplace.
Katz says that death spiral would be a lot less likely if lawmakers decide to create a system of nonprofit insurance cooperatives, which is also being discussed. One way or another, private insurance companies are probably going to face more competition. That means they'll have to cut costs and maybe jobs. Yale's Jacob Hacker thinks many of those workers would be able to find different positions in healthcare.
These people are going to be a vital part of reform because they're going to be working in areas where they're really improving the delivery and quality of care rather than just engaging in endless disputes with providers about billing.
That sounds promising, but to Christy Rue and the other 35,000 people who work for Aetna, it sounds like a lot of empty cubicles. in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, small businesses count cash and customers as times get leaner.
The financial people on TV, when they tell people to cut back, you know, they say, cut back on that morning latte. And and I'm like, please don't.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Worries that the recent stock rally has outpaced the economy sent Wall Street on its worst single-day plunge in over a month. The Dow fell 186 points, an even 2%, coming to rest at 9,135. The Nasdaq fared even worse, sliding 54 points, 2.75%, closing at 1930. And the S&P 500 lopped off 24 points, almost 2.5%, ending at 979. The rout was broad-based. Of the 30 stocks in the Dow, only Pfizer and Coca-Cola eked out fractional gains. Investors scattered to safe havens to put their money. The yen, the greenback, and U.S. Treasuries all rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is scheduled to meet with President Obama at the White House. Also in Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for July. And an actor with a long list of credits, including Heathers, Pump Up the Volume, and True Romance, celebrates his birthday. Christian Slater will be 40. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The Boston Globe's been doing some digging into where all the stimulus money went. Turns out some of it went toward rent, or at least toward pushing rentals as an alternative to homeownership. The Obama administration reportedly plans to push more than $4 billion into federally subsidized rental housing. It's a major shift from the Ownership Society programs of the Bush administration. Joe Williams is deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
So fill in some of the details of what the Department of Housing and Urban Development is doing. Where is this money going?
Basically, it's $14 billion in stimulus they got. They're using about $4 billion of it to construct new affordable rental housing nationwide. And that's housing that people can live in for a reasonable price. Some of it will be market rate. Some of it will be specifically targeted to low income. And it's targeted at backing off a little bit the ownership society that was so famously touted over the last couple of years.
Are more rental units going to start popping up across the country? Is this for urban areas? Any details there?
It'll be across the country. The one difficulty or the one sort of anxiety that they have about this is in markets that have typically been really, really expensive, places like Boston, for example. Market rate rental housing is really hard to find there. And to get enough land, to get enough people, to get enough of a project together to bid on an affordable housing development, it'll be interesting to see how well that goes.
How much of this new emphasis on renting do you think is a real shift in political thinking versus the practicalities of an upended housing market? I mean, it is not easy to buy a house right now.
It's a combination of both. They would like people to own homes, but the market is just absolutely disastrous right now. Let's go back to a more sensible policy, they say. Over the last couple of years, we've gotten it out of whack. People have chosen the path of getting a home first rather than renting as a way to get a home, doing the traditional path where you rent a place first that you can afford, you save the money, you build up enough for the 15, 10, 20% down payment, and then you get a home in a sensible mortgage that you can afford.
Certainly the notion of home ownership as an opportunity, something that could make your life better, that was not new to the Bush administration. It's kind of part of the American dream that we all know and love. I wonder, does this move toward renting mean that that dream changes in any significant way?
The wiseacre in me would say it's kind of a back to the future sort of scenario, and that the American dream has always been there. It's always been the dream to own a house. It's always been the dream to have a place of your own. But we kept trying to accelerate it and get it there quicker. And this is taking it back a step.
And what are proponents of more home ownership saying about this shift?
It was hard to find people who didn't like the renewed emphasis on renting. But many of them said, well, you know, we think that this makes sense, given all the wreckage that's surrounding us in the housing market. Sure, we would like people to own homes. Sure, we think that home ownership is a means to not only stabilize neighborhoods, but also families. It creates upward mobility for African Americans and Latinos who are typically underrepresented in the housing market. So they are saying that the home ownership society has its place, but it needs to be a little bit more sensible, it needs to be decelerated, and it needs to be de-emphasized.
Joe Williams is Deputy Chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Last month's unemployment figures did contain a ray of hope for recent college grads who may be wondering what exactly that diploma will get them in this economy. Figures show the unemployment rate for high school graduates is 9.4%. For those with a college degree, it's half that. Still, that is small comfort to commentator and new graduate Sarah Klinakis.
Easy for you to say, you've got a job. I said this to President Obama recently after he declared that, despite high unemployment rates, things are getting better. My beef isn't really with the president, but when you spend all day surfing job boards, even an image on TV can come under your wrath. When I decided to pursue a master's in writing, I knew I wouldn't get the job security of an MBA or CPA certificate, but I'd worked my way through grad school at a small PR firm, so with 4 years' work experience, I assumed that even in a rough economy, I was a viable job candidate. But the exciting prospect of a new career soon morphed into full-blown exasperation. I've built professional profiles online and asked everyone I know to keep their ears open. My vocabulary is swarming with phrases like highly motivated and results-driven. The objective atop my resume has been changed more often than a newborn. Cover letters clog my desktop, each one highlighting why I'm a perfect fit for the online magazine in Manhattan, the copywriting team in San Francisco, the think tank in D.C., the nonprofit in Boston, even the retailer in Maine. 4 months and 50 applications later, I haven't had a single interview, only nightmares of moving back in with my parents. That's when the panic starts. Like an insecure girlfriend, I'm filled with questions. Did I do something to turn off my potential employers? Was I too anxious? Soon, I'm reliving every dance I never had a date to. I want to believe President Obama when he says things are getting better, just as I want to believe all the effort and money I sunk into my education will eventually pay off. But what happens next? When I'm my parents' tenant with a resume that remains unnoticed, when will these better things finally trickle down to me? Until then, I'll keep applying. As a highly motivated and results-driven individual, would you expect anything less?
Sarah Klinakis is a recent graduate of George Mason University's creative writing program. She is still looking for work. What's your recession job hunt story? Did you succeed? Are you still looking? We want to hear about it. Go to marketplace.org. Maybe our previous commentator should move to Nebraska. That state has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country, 5% versus the national average of more than 9.5%. But as Sarah McCammon reports from NET Radio, numbers that look okay on paper may not translate well in real life, especially in real rural life.
It's a sunny afternoon in Minden, Nebraska, a small community surrounded by fields of corn and soybeans. Carrie Bloom is remodeling the inside of a white house. He's been doing projects like this on his own since he was laid off last fall from his job with a commercial drywall company.
To be alone on a job by yourself in a homeowner's place, it's just kind of different that way.
Bloom is in his early 40s with glasses and a salt and pepper beard. He says he could probably find a job with another company, but that might require moving to a larger city like Lincoln or Omaha. That would mean less time with his wife and two teenage sons, one of whom is starting college this fall. And Bloom says he doesn't want to start at the bottom again.
I'm not a young man anymore. It's hard to keep up with some of the kids that are in the trade, and, I could just see if they got slow, I'd probably be the first one to go.
Bloom hasn't filed for unemployment, so he doesn't show up in unemployment statistics for the state. Ernie Goss is an economist with Creighton University in Omaha. He says many workers here string together part-time jobs or get discouraged by the lack of opportunities in rural areas and give up the search. Nebraska's unemployment rate sounds good. It's only about half the nation's average. But Goss says those figures don't fully capture what's happening in the rural areas.
And the unemployment rates are low by comparison, but those are disguised because there are individuals out there that would be more than willing to take one of these jobs. But to be counted in unemployment, you have to be out of work looking for work.
And so a lower unemployment rate creates a myth that people in rural agricultural places somehow have it easier. Randy Cantrell has studied rural communities at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
They're able to grow their own tomatoes or something out there, and therefore they're sort of in this frontier model, able to survive these things better because they were doing things for themselves anyway. But the reality of that is that there is enmeshed in the big economic picture as the rest of us are.
For Kerry Bloom, being without a steady job means his income has dropped about $1,000 a month. That's especially tough when Bloom's wife, Sherry Brewer, is struggling to keep her business alive. She opened Brewer's Coffee House in Minden 2 years ago, and at first she made a profit. But now Brewer says she's not even making a salary.
I always get upset when I see the financial people on TV when they tell people to cut back. You know, they say, cut back on that morning latte, and I'm like, please don't.
Sitting together in the empty coffee shop, Sherry Brewer and Kerry Bloom say they're treading water.
I would say this last year has been just
different.
Dreadful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's financially hard, you argue more. But at the same time, we tell each other, it's like, if we can get through this, we can get through anything.
But they admit the income uncertainty and the long hours are taking their toll. In Minden, Nebraska, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the Reader's Digest version. Reader's Digest ran out of money. It racked up too much debt. It's headed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The end. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 186 points, 2%. The Nasdaq fell 54 points, 2.75%. And the S&P 500 lopped off 24 points, nearly 2.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Next time on the program, a new menu of options for the free lunch program.
We have a difficult time reassuring our parents, who may in fact really qualify, that they should fill out the application.
I'm Tess Vigland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.